Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Musician's Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Mark. And before I get started with today's episode, let me just say that I hope you all had an incredible Christmas. Talking of Christmas, if you feel like doing us a solid and leaving us a little something, please leave us a rating or a review or a share. It helps us. It helps us get discovered more. It puts us higher up in the rankings, etc., etc. Thank you. Anyway, my guest today is Brazilian-born Greco Barato. He's a music composer, a musician, a producer, an author, a poet. In fact, Greco has a list of musical accomplishments that would take me quite a while to read through. So just to give you a few bullet points, he has toured and worked with artists like Gwen Stefani, Shakira, Katie Lang, Earth, Wind & Fire, Enrique Iglesias. The list goes on and on. He also has a book of poetry that was recently published. You can check that out with the links in our show notes. But for now, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Greco Barato. Hey Greco, it's Travis from The Musician's Mentor. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good, man. Good. We're going to jump straight into it. I know you're a busy man, and I can't thank you enough for giving us your time. But basically what I do with every episode is I ask my guest to do a brief introduction on themselves. So rather than me just hyping you up to our listeners, I try and get the listeners to kind of gauge your mindset, where you're coming from. It's just better from the source. So if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about Greco Barato, what you've done, and you know, where you're currently at in life.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. All right. So I was born and raised in Brazil, in the south of Brazil. When I was 12 years old, I found out this catalog for a school named GIT, Musicians Institute, and became obsessed about attending it as soon as I finished high school. And I did that. I moved to California, to LA, to go to school. I went to school for 2.5 years. Did the regular one-year program, and then I got a scholarship for 1.5 years to attend classes and be part of a project they had called Band Clinic. And after that, I began working as a after a few odd jobs in LA, I began working as a professional musician, played in, you know, Baptist churches, played in the Brazilian music scene in LA. That led me to meet a bunch of American musicians who introduced me or recommended me to a bunch of different gigs. You know, my first big gig was with Sergio Mendes back in 2000. Then I did a bunch of studio stuff, recorded with Boyz II Men, Pink, Dionne Warwick, Earth, Wind & Fire, George Duke, Christina Aguilera. And then I went on the road for a while, and I've, you know, changed gears a little bit, and touring became my main activity. And then I, you know, throughout the years, I got to tour with Anastasia, Enrique Iglesias, Shakira, Katie Lang. Most recent projects involved, I did a bunch of, actually nowadays I'm doing more subs, you know, subbing for friends. And I got to do that with Lionel Richie and keep doing that with Enrique Iglesias. And I also have subbed on LP. So yeah, this is where I'm at the moment. I've been touring with an artist that does meditation music, and she's called Sanatan Kaur, and we've done a bunch of tours and a couple of albums. We just wrapped up a tour in North America. And now I'm currently in Brazil to release a book of poetry that I had texts that I've had since forever, but never never left the drawer or the notebooks, and a bunch of, in an album as well, instrumental music, just an acoustic guitar, you know, sort of like lullabies and stuff like that.
So, I mean, a few things that we can kind of segue from there, which I'm going to kind of bring it back around to, especially with the book of poetry, because I want to ask a few questions about that. But let's just kind of back it up so that our timeline kind of makes sense here. So coming to the States from Brazil, was your first time doing that to study at MI?
I had been. I spent a month in upstate New York with a friend of my dad's, and I got to experience, you know, being an American for a month. He had two kids. One of them was about my age. And, you know, I got to ride the yellow bus to school and go to high school for a month and, you know, go to New York. And at the time, go to Hard Rock Cafe and go to 48th Street, you know, where they had Manny's and Sam Ash and, you know, and experience that, which was pretty incredible, you know, at the time. This is like 92. This is like 30 years ago. So we didn't have, you know, I come from the south of Brazil. It's a very modest place. And we didn't have the facility or the, you know, access to all of the stuff in the world like we do today with the, you know, tips of our finger, you know, internet, and you can pretty much see everything and, you know, discover a bunch of stuff that at the time you just didn't have access to that. So that was pretty amazing. So, and once I did that, I spent that month, I think it was December 92, I came back and I was even more determined to move to LA. So that was my second, you know, trip actually ever.
Oh, ever? Or just to the States? Oh, that's amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know it's possibly an ignorant question to ask because I'm sure it's an amazing experience, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You spoke about how you really wanted to get to MI or GIT as it once was. Right. And I noticed via some of your Instagram posts that one of your teachers there was Ross Bolton. Now, you know, I know of Ross because of his like educational DVDs and books and stuff like that. Massive fan of the guy. I wish I had gotten to meet him back when he was still with us. But, you know, without trying to sort of sound redundant, because again, I'm sure the experience was wonderful, tell us a little bit about your experience at MI. And more specifically, if you wouldn't mind, just to kind of pay a few respects to Ross here, what was it like studying under him?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, go for it.
So to me, MI was, it was an incredible experience. It was super formative and beneficial. And I'm part of a generation, especially in Brazil, that we were really tuned into all of those virtuoso players, you know, like the shred type of school of guitar playing. So, you know, Steve Vai, Satriani, Eric Johnson, and then you get into Greg Howe and Vinnie Moore and Michael Lee Firkins and Malmsteen and all that stuff. So growing up or as a teenager, I was really into that, and I was really good at playing fast lines and scales and arpeggios and that stuff. Actually, I won a contest in my home state that involved writing a 3.5 minute piece of music or a solo, and you had to perform it solo. And I ended up winning it. And, you know, so I was good at that. And then I got to MI, and this, you know, multiverse of styles and languages and influences and, you know, and in music, you know, just opened up. And, you know, for the first 6 months, my focus was to learn how to read music because I didn't know how to. So I had a deal with myself where I would, you know, the deal was this. The moment I opened up my eyes, being at 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was, I would get up, have breakfast and go to school and try to get a couple hours of just sight reading practice before our scheduled classes. And I did that for about 6 months, the first two quarters of the course. Mm-hmm. And then after that, there was a change in direction or perspective. I really got interested in becoming a studio musician or a sideman or something like that, because we were exposed to, like, you know, Michael Thompson, Michael Landau, and Tommy Tedesco came and gave a lecture, and it was, you know, it became more about that, becoming a professional musician and a sideman and all that stuff. And so I was also a huge fan of Dominic Miller, who played and still plays with Sting. And so what I did for the second semester was rhythm guitar. That was my focus. And I figured out that I didn't have a lot of experience playing in ensembles and bands and stuff like that. So my focus was purely that, you know, how to develop rhythm guitar playing, you know, right hand and sounds and experimenting with that. And that led to Ross Bolton, because he was the guru.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so I used to live at his open counseling. You know, every week he had 2 or 3 hours of open counseling. Was a class where he had a room and he had like 2 or 3 hours a week where he would counsel students, you know, that who were not his private students or who were not in his core curriculum classes. And it was a very sought after class, you know, and I would, you know, people would line up, you know, 30 minutes before class, you know, his little room. And I would be there every week and, you know, devour anything that he would give me. We all had portable cassette recorders, so he would play with us. Oh, you know, let's play this groove. And I've posted this on my Instagram. I have a page of rhythmic studies or ideas or exercises that he gave me and also other students in the classroom. And I would transcribe them and I started to record them, you know. So that's what I did. I just hung out with him in class. And then eventually, I think one time he invited a few of his students to go and have like a end of the year celebration at his place. And we had dinner. And then this was, I don't know, 97, right? And when I got the, when I started working with Katie Lang, I remember rehearsing at a place called Center Staging in LA. And he was rehearsing next door for a NAMM show because he used to play at the Yamaha concert. And we reconnected and it was amazing. And it was so, and then I met him shortly after that. And we talked about, you know, an album that he wanted to put out, a new album, and how he wanted to, you know, he felt like he needed to do that. And I was in the midst of, I was in the middle of, you know, recording my first album at the time. And, you know, we got to hang a little bit, you know, and it was amazing. It was just, he was such a great guy. He was such a great player, a great teacher. He was, you know, there was there's a community of people who had studied with him. And I keep in touch with a couple of guys who are also my teachers at the time. One guy was called Lupo Grönig. He's from Austria, amazing player, producer, lives in Hong Kong right now. So yeah, Ross was a mentor, an example. It was an amazing experience to study with him. And, you know, and when he passed, it was like, it was very quick how it happened. But I remember playing a show and looking at my right hand and it was like, man, he's still alive. That's where Ross lives.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In the right hands of, you know, thousands of guitar players.
Yeah. Now, that guy's right hand is just phenomenal. I mean,
yeah.
There's a couple of clips on YouTube that I stumble across every now and then. And I'm just like, he's like you often hear people talk about, You know, especially drummers who play guitar, you'll often hear them describe how they play, treating the guitar like a percussion instrument. But that guy really nails it. I mean, he hits it home. It's like he's playing percussion, but
yeah,
on a stringed instrument. It's really great, you know. No, great guy, yeah. Man, great guy. Okay, so Greco, before we jump into your journey as like a player much more, let's talk a little bit about your path as a writer slash composer. I saw that you did a little bit of writing for shows like Dawson's Creek and Brothers and Sisters, a whole bunch of others. How did this aspect of your career come about? And what advice could you potentially give our listeners who want to potentially pursue that part of the musical career?
Well, this happened. I was working with a producer in LA, and he mainly did like hip hop tracks and stuff like that. But he was put in charge of writing the songs for a movie called First Daughter, directed by a guy named Forrest Whitaker. And I think the composer attached to the project was Michael Kamen. And Michael Kamen passed not long after signing onto the project or something like that. And his assistant or his apprentice or his mentee, if you will, took over. And then we met in these sessions. And his name is Blake Neely. And we hit it off, you know, and he ended up calling me to do work for him on a few other shows that he was working. And then he kept calling me, and he was he's the guy who, you know, wrote the music for all these. Dawson's Creek was separate, but for Brothers and Sisters and a bunch of shows that I'm not going to remember all the names of it. But what, you know, we hit it off. He started calling me, and then at some point he just say, "Hey, you know, come over. I'm just going to record you playing some acoustic guitar, and you know, if when I use these cues, you get, you know, cue sheet credits." And that's how it happened. He was gracious, or, you know, honest or straightforward enough to do that, you know. Sometimes not even I wouldn't know that he used some stuff until I would get like the royalty statements, and they would say, "Oh, you know, Brothers and Sisters, such and such cue episode, such, such," because he had done it. He had a bunch of stuff in his hard drive that I played. And so that's how that happened. Dawson's Creek was a song that I produced and played on, and it ended up being on the, you know, after the opening or the first scene. And it just got submitted and accepted it. I had more to say about that, but that was what happened.
No, that's great. And,
you know, as far as advice, I would say, you know, put yourself out there. That's the thing. It's relationships. It's who you know. But, you know, it's focusing on what you want. I think nowadays there's so many avenues and aspects of the music business that can be pursued. I think the more you focus on one, the better chance you have of getting positive results.
Yeah, that's actually a great way to look at it. For you personally, tell us how, if you're composing for TV, like how is that different to say writing songs or producing an album for you? Or when you're composing for TV, are you following, like, I know you mentioned cue sheets there, so are you following certain direction, or is it a matter of sometimes you just playing around in studio and someone says, like this guy you mentioned, "Hey, that's a cool little idea, let's lay that down," and they keep it on their hard drive in case somebody needs something that maybe sounds like whatever that feeling created?
I think it's a little bit of all of them or both of them. Some it's different because you have to actually tell a story or help tell the story of what's happening in the scene. And also every scene has a rhythm, you know. Sometimes the rhythm is dictated by a temp track that was used to cut the scene with. And some people would like to, and so, you know, and sometimes, most of the times, directors or producers, as we all do, you know, we become attached to the demo, to the temp, and then it's the composer's track job to, you know, marry aspects of the temp that work with your own artistic creative vision, you know, of what should be in the track or the cue, and also the agreement on the vision that you have with the director and producer.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is a question of, some composers, they do what they do and people hire them for that. And that's a huge blessing, I think, because you're being hired to be who you are. And therefore, you're not conforming to, you don't have to chase the demo or the temp track or anything like that. But, you know, those are, I think that's the exception to the rule.
Yeah, it's kind of the same as, I suppose, the songwriting thing, you know, like sometimes to get to that point where people are coming to sort of see you as an artist or a writer versus maybe being a sideman, that's really like winning the lottery. I mean, winning the lottery is being, you've toured with such amazing, massive artists. That itself is massive success. There are musicians who would kill for that. But yeah. I suppose when you kind of put it in the grand scheme of things, like the composition thing, you know, then there's like these pockets, like, man, some people will niche out a career like the artist with the meditation music. That's really unique and just phenomenal that like someone can make a career where someone will go and watch them for that kind of art. It's incredible.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, moving on with the you as a musician stuff. Bit of a strange one again, but as a musician / sideman or artist, are you managed or do you take care of your business side of things yourself?
I am not managed at the moment. I was briefly managed, I don't know, around 2004, 2003. I used to work a lot at the studio in LA called Enterprise Studios, and this amazing mixing engineer called Dave Pensato had a room downstairs. And so I got to meet him, and he mixed a bunch of stuff that I had recorded guitars on, and I eventually met his manager at the time. And then we started talking and, you know, met a few times, and, you know, we agreed to see if we could collaborate. You know, and we did that for a little bit, and I got a few gigs out of that, but that was it. Mostly, it's all word of mouth. And, you know, you have to deal with the business side of things, which I think it's kind of unfair, but it's definitely unbalanced situation, because as a musician, as an artist, you're in one mindset, and then you have to deal with managers and business people whose sole job is to negotiate. And therein lies to me the unbalance aspect of the situation, because that's what they do every day. That's what they've done for years. That's what they went to school to learn and develop. And plus they're hiring you. So they have a few levels of upper hand, you know. But there are situations where people want you. And I think in those situations, you have a little bit more of leverage, you know.
I mean, like the podcast is a good example there. Like the fact that I could talk to you directly, to get you as a guest, it makes my life so much easier. Whereas, like, I sometimes have to deal with, like, you know, PR people or certain managements and stuff. And it's like, listen, 9 times out of 10, we get it right. But every now and then, sometimes, and this is just my experience, maybe you've seen something similar. Sometimes when there's like a lot of correspondence going back and forth between various parties. So let's say hypothetically, if I had, we'll just use you as a guest on the podcast for an example. If I had to talk to a PR person or a manager who then wants me to talk to a PR person who then has to talk to you, I find that sometimes it's almost like a broken telephone effect where it's like you really just need a yes or no sometimes. And if I could just get the yes or no from the source, it comes like quick and you go, oh, okay, you want to do it, great. You don't want to do it, that's cool too. But sometimes I find with some agent type people, it's easier for them to kind of just like send things back and forth. And it could take months, years sometimes to get an answer. And it's like, it's very bizarre to me because I get that they often have loads of artists or clients on their books. But I do wonder sometimes how much work, you know, and I'm sure they think it's to the artist's advantage, but I do sometimes wonder how much musicians lose work-wise from certain managers because the managers just don't think it might be a good idea, you know, without talking to them.
I do wish I had a manager, and I see the role of a manager as a partner more than anything. It's somebody who believes in the product or what you have to offer and sees possibilities that perhaps as an artist, one does not see. And three, is able to connect those dots. You know, oh, I have this network of contacts. I see these possibilities. And I think I can make this happen, taking you from point A to point B in your career, or discussing with the artist where is it that you want to go. You know, so I think that's great. That's amazing. I also think of referring more to what you just said, that sometimes it, you know, adds time and multiple emails and stuff like that. That in the end, management does represent the artist. So perhaps if it takes that long, or if it's not as clear-cut communication, perhaps that's a reflection of the artist as well. And I remember being at a gig where I was faced with the choice of like, well, I can continue in this situation, or I can do my part and say no to the situation. And if the artist then says, oh, I didn't know about this, I didn't know this was happening. See, I think playing the card of, I didn't know this was happening is as responsible, carries as much responsibility as playing the card of, I knew this was happening and this is what I'm offering.
Yeah.
Either way, the artist is the head of the company. And so as an artist, you have to know what your company is and how it works and what people representing you are doing. You know, and of course, it's more comfortable to say, "Oh, I didn't know this was happening." You know, it's a buffer. You know, but I do believe that either way, you know, you're responsible, and your management is going to reflect that. You know, so you know, it's great in the business side of things. It's great to have a manager, but you know, you're still the head honcho. And you know, I remember a friend who was playing with the boss, you know, Bruce Springsteen, and he was telling me about his experience, and he was saying, you know, I talked to the manager, and then at one time Bruce came to me and said, hey, everything all right with so and so? Yeah, everything good. And then he goes like, okay, if at any point something is not right or you don't feel like it's right, you come and talk to me if things that don't get worked out with my manager.
Wow. That's really enlightening to hear.
Maybe. He knows.
That's why they call him the boss, man.
Exactly. That's you know, that illustrates the example of like, I'm in charge of the company.
Yeah.
The buck stops with me.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, as an artist, sometimes we don't want to be in charge of every single aspect because it's a lot. It's overwhelming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, when it comes to working with musicians sometimes as well, you know, to not to make this negative, but sometimes when there's conflict within groups, you know, the artist doesn't want to, you don't want to be that guy, you know, it's like, so get your manager to do it. It's like,
yeah, you have to have a bulldog.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. It's understandable.
So, you know, we briefly touched on some of the artists you've played with, and you did talk a little bit about networking. So again, I'm not trying to seem ignorant here with my question, but for those interested, how do you try and make the transition from, let's say you're a local musician playing in your scene, you may be doing very well, maybe it's your career, I don't know, you know, I'm again being hypothetical, and you want to level things up, you want to start trying to get the bigger gigs. With someone like yourself who's played with people like, you know, Katie Lang, Gwen Stefani, Shakira, Enrique, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on. What advice, if any, could you offer listeners on trying to step their game up who might want to start trying to aim for those kind of gigs or that kind of work?
Well, I think I was talking about this the other day, you know, and I said, well, it, you know, it's luck. At some point, it's also luck. And then somebody said, well, I don't believe in luck because, you know, and to me, luck is when opportunity presents itself, you're prepared, you know, for said opportunity. So I think nowadays it's a little bit different because of the internet and Instagram, and you can, as an artist, for, let's say, I could have access to any player in the world, right? Because I see their Instagram and they're an amazing player, and I like the vibe and I like the look, and it's like, okay, I want to hire that person. All right, well, then it's up to management and tour management to figure out if that's doable or not. When I started, it was about being in the right place. And by that, I mean being in a city where the music business, you know, operates in. And when I started, it was LA or it was New York. At the time, New York had a, you know, I remember, oh yeah, he's using a New York band or he's using an LA band. Nashville has its own ecosystem and it has changed over the years now with more independent artists and Americana type of music being done there. And then Miami, usually, you know, deals with Latin artists, you know, or Spanish speaking and singing artists. So I think you would have to be in a center where things happen. And then you would have to put yourself out there again. You have to go out and meet people. All the gigs I got was because I met somebody who ended up working with an artist or recommending me. You know, Anastasia and Enrique happened because I co-produced a song with a buddy of mine who had a studio, and we called in a bass player named Dan Rothschild, who's an amazing bass player.
Yeah.
And then he came in, played the track, you know, and I had played the guitars. Okay, cool. Thank you, Dan. Great meeting you. I had heard of him, et cetera, et cetera. Few weeks, maybe a month or two later, he passed my name to a guitar player named Yogi Lonich, who was looking for a sub for the Anastasia gig because the MD couldn't make this month of promo touring. And, you know, he asked Yogi. Yogi recommended myself, you know, me and a few other players. And I happened to be the one who responded the quickest, or, you know, and maybe that was it, you know, So I responded to the MD, and the MD is like, okay, great. Can you do it? It's like, yeah, I can do it. Okay, great. Meet me tonight at this place, and I'll give you the CD with, or the tape. I think it was CD with the songs. And that was the audition, actually. It was not actually, at the time I didn't know it, but it came, you know, it revealed itself later that he was more interested in the hang, you know, am I a person that, you know, he would want to hang with than the playing, because the playing is understood that I could play. Otherwise it wouldn't have been recommended.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah,
that seems to be a common theme with a lot of the guys that I speak to, you know, the hang and just, are you somebody that people are going to want to be on a tour bus for weeks on end, you know? So
yeah.
That's very interesting. So you guys just met, what, at a bar or something, and he gave you the CD, and because that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we met at this bar. We had a glass of wine, I think, and, you know, okay, cool. I'll see you at rehearsal. It's this day and this time and this place.
That's amazing.
You know, and then he was the music director for Enrique. So I did the gig with Anastasia. I did the month of promo. And then he was like, oh, I think Enrique might like you. So I think next year he's going to be touring. We'll touch base again.
Amazing.
2006 rolled in, and he was like, all right, there's a gig in Spain, and we're only going to play for an hour. Do you want to come in and see if, you know, you want to come in audition? It's like, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what happened. Went in, auditioned, played the gig. And after the gig, it was like, yeah, great. He liked you. You want to keep doing this? Like, yeah, sure. Kept doing that. With Shakira, it was through Brendan, who we've you know, interviewed as well. I remember KD called me, and she said, hey, you know, next year, I had been playing with her for 2 years. And she's like, hey, next year, I'm going to go on tour. But the guy who produced my album is a guitar player, and I cannot take three guitar players on the road.
Yeah.
So if you have any jobs that, you know, job offers, I want you to take them because, you know, I'm not going to be able to take you. And one, that was the only thing that ever happened, you know, where an artist calls you personally and saying, hey, you know what? I wish I could, but I can't take you next year. If you have offers, you know, please take them. And so I made a list of people that I knew and say, hey, you know, and called every one of them and say, hey, I'm looking for work for next year because I have to finish my album and I need money. If you know of anything, you know, let me know. Keep me in mind. And I called Brendan, and Brendan was like, okay, at the moment, I think we're all good here. The band she's pretty happy with the band. Cool. But if anything happens, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
A month went by or something like that. And he's like, well, actually, are you still looking for a gig? I was like, yeah. Well, she's looking for a player now. I think we're going to change guitar players. Can I recommend you? And, you know, there was only like five people auditioning, you know, maybe, you know, the bass player recommended somebody, the tour manager recommended somebody, Brendan recommended somebody, the music creative director of the tour recommended somebody. I was like, yeah, sure. I'll come and audition. Same thing. Went in, learned the songs, you know. And at the time they were rehearsing in Canada, already rehearsing for the tour. So they flew each one of us on a separate day. We went in, played with the band, and had lunch with the band. Hmm. You know, that's the hang component.
Yeah.
You know, went back home, kept doing what I was doing, and, you know, got an email. Hey, you know, the gig is yours if you want it. Let us know. And, you know, and that's it. It's who you know and who recommends you and you know, how are you... Are you a good hang? Are you a person easy to get along with? And, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. A whole bunch of like people kind of, I don't want to say people's skills, but people elements, you know, like the music, it's part of it, of course, you know, without it, the conversation wouldn't be happening, but it's like, you know, I've known a couple incredible musicians in my life who unfortunately walked around like they thought that the whole world should be treating them like they're incredible musicians. And, you know, I still know them, but they don't seem to work. They stay in their rooms practicing all day. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's fantastic. No. But like, it's interesting if they had just taken different approaches with people. Maybe they would be household names, you know. Maybe not. Who knows?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, maybe the maybe world is what if, you know.
Yeah.
Same thing. You know, and I've been in auditions. I remember a buddy of mine used to play with Pink, and he was leaving the band, and he was like, hey, do you want to come audition? They asked me for somebody. And, you know, and I did. But I was not as well prepared as later as in a few years later. And they had someone in mind already, you know. And, you know, and that someone is still doing the gig. Which brings me to the point, I was like, sometimes if the gig is yours, the gig is yours.
And yes.
You know, it's one of those things. It's like, I don't know why I'm here, but I'm here and okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
So Greco, what do you think has been the hardest part about being a self-employed musician for you?
I think I'm actually going, I'm not going to say that I'm going through it, but I think it's, I think in earlier in life, you have, it seems like you have more time. And as you get older and you start to go into a different phase of life, then it's more like, all right, a year or two when you're 28 is not the same as when you're 43.
Yeah.
You know, so it becomes more, time becomes more valuable as it, as you age, and also going into a stage of life where perhaps you're not gonna, where you have to change gears again and go into, all right, well, I'm not going to be touring as much because, you know, it's, I think it's a young people's game.
Yeah.
You know, and so making that transition of like, all right, and being at peace with it. All right. I did all these things. They were amazing. Now time to shift gears into what's next, whatever that is. Sometimes we don't know. Most of the times we don't know. You know, so I think that's, you know, people will say that not knowing what next month is going to be like, and, you know, that's all true. It takes a certain kind of personality to be able to navigate that and be at ease as much as one can be at ease with the fact that, you know, today I don't know what is going to happen next month, and maybe I'll get a call, you know, 2 days from now, and my whole year next year is going to be taken.
Yeah.
You know.
And how important do you think being flexible in those positions are? Like, I mean, I know you're working on your own material. I know you've got the book of poetry. I know that you're doing a lot of production. So, like, if you, I don't want to make this sound like you have to prioritize certain things over others, but if you've, say, booked working with certain artists from a production point of view, or you know that you're going to go and do a certain amount of gigs for your own self, like for your own music, and you get a call to do one of these other things, are you at a point in your life where you make that decision based on, and I'm not trying to be too personal here, but is that decision based purely on finances, or are you in a point where it's like really you are searching more for the things that fulfill your soul, for as kind of arty-farty as that sounds?
I think it all depends on where one is in life. I did have a panic attack when I was 28 because I was not prioritizing the jobs I was doing versus, I don't want to say quality because they're all good. It's just a matter of being aligned with what I wanted to do or not. So in that sense, I will use the word quality of jobs that I was doing. you know, and that I ended up at the hospital because I thought I was going to have a heart attack. And I, you know, if I closed my eyes, I wouldn't wake up. And then after I ended up at the hospital, I decided to reassess and review a few things. And at that time it was like, all right, how much do I need to, you know, what's my overhead? What do I need to do? And let's start picking things based on, you know, whether they're going to fulfill me as a person, as a player, as, you know, if it's musically challenging, if it's people I like, if it's music I like, you know, if it's something I want to be involved with.
Yeah.
But obviously everybody has different financial needs. And, you know, if you have a house to pay and kids and all that stuff, then priorities are going to be different than if you don't. It's up to each one, or, you know, each person to figure out what that equation is. You know, oh, I need this, but I also, and yeah, I mean, I think nowadays it is based on fulfilling, needs to express myself and, you know, be the artist. But at the same time, you know, if something comes along where financially it's, if it's, positive, or, you know, it's something I can't say no to, then, you know, I'm not gonna say no to, you know?
Yeah. It makes total sense.
Yeah.
So I want to briefly touch on the poetry thing, and again, possibly a jump the gun type question. But so, what brought you on to write the book of poetry? I tell you, when I read about that, what I thought, and I could be completely off the mark, but this is why I figured I would ask. So, you know, typically when musicians also write, because not every musician writes and composes and stuff, but typically when a lot of musicians write, especially nowadays, that, you know, they'll keep, like, anytime they think of a clever lyric or a clever line or something, they'll put it in their notes, right? The Apple Notes or whatever phone notes you have. So is this kind of something that maybe prompted the book of poetry? Did you maybe have, like, notes and you found you had all these notes? And again, I'm spitballing here. This is just the way I pictured it in my head. Did you have, like, notes and someday you found yourself with all these notes and thought, you know, I could probably refine this and make a book of poetry?
Yes and no. I do have the notes.
Okay.
You know, and I do write when a verse comes, or a lyric idea comes, or a line comes, I do write them either on my note, on a proper paper notebook, or the notes app. But actually what this, you know, this writing poetry came, how it came was that after this panic attack, I was studying, I was reading about dreams and trying to get into lucid dreaming and, you know, being conscious while I was dreaming and all that stuff. And I had a dream diary, you know, or a log, where I would just write down every dream that I remembered. I would wake up and write it down. So one night, I had a dream that I was sitting at a table having a cup of coffee with two of my favorite writers, right? And in this dream, I had this sense that perhaps I had something to say that they hadn't said. And I woke up very happy about that, you know. Yeah. And, you know, I wrote the dream and went, took a shower. And then while I'm taking a shower, I felt this, like, I need to write, I need to write, I need to write. So I got off the shower, sat down, opened my notebook, and, you know, began to write in a stream of consciousness way, where I was not worried about editing or censoring myself. It was, I wasn't even thinking. I was just, all right, just write it down. I don't need to read it. I just need to put it out, get it out. So I did that, closed the notebook, and went about my day. And I, you know, came back the next day and the following day and the day after that. And I kept doing that for weeks, months, you know, where it was sort of like a therapy type of intention, you know, let's just, you know, just let it out.
Yeah.
And eventually the first text in form of a lyric came, you know, and okay, well, this looks like a verse and it has a certain sort of rhythm and rhyming scheme and all that stuff. So I began to do that. You know, every day I would write one or two lyrics, you know, lyric or a poem or, you know, verses or whatever. And then I just kept writing and I kept, you know, turning the pages and writing and writing and writing until a song, you know, in full form came, music and lyrics, because up to then I had just written either music or lyrics. So when that first song came, then the focus became that. I started writing songs that eventually ended up being my first album. But I also kept, you know, putting, you know, ideas down. And after releasing the first album, I did the promo thing. I did a few shows, traveled, you know, very independently, very low budget, but, you know, did it. And I was kind of, I had nothing to say at that point. I was kind of done with, you know, I that's it. I was like empty, you know, so I was like, all right, don't have anything to say. I'm going to do other things. And then at around 2016, I started thinking, well, maybe I could, you know, go back and see all those lyrics that I wrote and put them together. You know, talk to a friend and, you know, let it simmer. And it wasn't until the pandemic hit that I really sat down and selected all the texts that I thought had still had some honesty or relevance or that still rang true to, you know, to where I was at that moment, put them all together and started the process of, you know, okay, let's send this to a friend who's a journalist and a writer and see what she thinks about it. And the feedback was positive, started posting on Facebook and the feedback was positive. And then I started looking for a publishing company here in Brazil and, you know, eventually found one and that's it. And this is, that was the process.
That's amazing, man. I love it when things happen organically. I'm a big fan, you know. I think sometimes if we force things that you can sense it, you know, at least if you're in tune, a lot of people don't always realize, but I feel like I can. And so, like, I love stories like that. Super inspiring. Greco, last question I ask everybody. What do you think has been the best piece of advice you've ever received? Or if you don't feel like kind of sort of brain scanning your life for that piece of information, what do you feel has been kind of the best or biggest piece of advice you've learned along the way?
Yeah. I mean, when I was in school, I remember, and I met a guy who became one of my best friends, and I am godfather to his first daughter. We're from the south of Brazil. We had friends in common. And I remember asking him, and it's like, hey, what's missing? Because I've been putting my time, I do all the practicing and shedding, and, you know, what's missing? And he said to me, well, what's missing is that you have to go out and live life. You have to break your heart. You have to get, and I'm not advocating for use of substances at any, you know, but he said, you have to go and get drunk. You have to go and, you know, fall in love and not have that love be answered back in the same manner. You have to just go out and experience life. And that will bring something into your playing and into your music that nobody else can do, because it's your experiences, and that's what makes it your music and your way of playing. And I did take that to heart, and it did change, everything. It changed my playing, my relationship with myself, life. And so, yeah, it ends up at the tips of your fingers eventually.
Yeah. That's so cool, man.
And that's what people respond to.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I think you're on the money. I think it's so simple, but it's so true. You know, it's like, again, you almost can't fake it, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, you can to a point, you know, there's musicians or artists out there, you know, it's a product, you know, it wasn't necessarily legit or even the way songwriting's gone, you know, you sometimes know that the artist singing the song isn't the writer and they just deliver that song really well. But you're so right, man. It's like those experiences, they come through. It affects your playing. It affects the way it gets heard. It's everything, you know.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that the way I did it is the way for the next person, because sometimes it means something completely different. But, you know, it's just you have to find what does it for you, and, you know, that authenticity will reflect back on your playing, on your artistry, or whatever it is. You know, if it means going to being celibate and being in the cave for a month or two or 3 years or whatever, if that's what it is, then that's what it is. But you have to find it and go for it.
Exactly. All right, Greco Barazzo, thank you so very much for your time, sir. I had fun, man. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you, man. It was a pleasure.
I will. I'll link all your information in the show notes when it's time to put the episode out. But dude, good luck with everything, and I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thank you.
Sweet. There we have it. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you, Greco, for your time. 2024, I'm changing format slightly. So if you're on the social media platforms like Instagram and TikTok, Facebook, do me a favor, give me a follow. I'm going to be posting content there as well as the usual streaming sites. I know I say it in every episode, but please leave me a rating or a review. For more information on Greco, check out the list of show notes. For more information on me, check out travismark.com or head to musicians-mentor.com. Until next time, stay blessed. Have a wonderful end of 2023.